Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guests are Mika Corazon and Lee Ellen Marvin from Suicide Prevention and Crisis Service of Tompkins County. Mika Corazon worked in the field of HIV/AIDS education and advocacy for 17 years in California. Locally, she has worked as regional director for AIDS work and was program director for the Community Dispute Resolution Center. She is currently crisis line director for Suicide Prevention and Crisis Service and is responsible for recruitment, training, and supervision of volunteer counselors. Lee Ellen Marvin has devoted over 25 years to exploring the art and craft of storytelling. As a scholar and educator, she has explored ways in which storytelling defines personal identity, empathy, and community involvement. She is currently the Director of Education at Suicide Prevention Crisis Services, where she uses storytelling and other art forms to raise awareness about suicide. And welcome to the show to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tish.
Now, suicide prevention and crisis began in the late 1960s, is what I understand, following a series of suicides. Tell us a little bit about the history.
There were, I believe, two young people died on the Cornell campus, and some students went to Jack Lewis, who was one of the chaplains on campus, and said, "What are you going to do? What are you going to do?" I think it's interesting, you know, those are interesting times, and I think that sense of we will respond to this, and we expect you, as our religious leader and supporter, to figure out what needs to happen here.
Mm-hmm.
So it began very much as a volunteer effort. As I understand it, at first, the crisis line phone number didn't have a place to ring. It was a phone number that was forwarded to different people's homes.
Oh, yes.
And at first, they just had a few calls a month, and then they started getting a couple of calls a day, and now we have a couple of calls an hour.
Yeah, yeah. Those are the statistics I read, too. The first year you had 387 calls. Now you get over 11,000 a year.
That's correct.
That's amazing. Do you have anything to add about the history, Mika?
Well, I've worked on so many crisis lines, and what's really amazing about this line that it has continued for 41 years now, uninterrupted answering of this phone, 24/7. Anybody in pain and distress can call us at 3 a.m. and they'll get a live human being who will be compassionate and ready to listen to whatever it is that's going on for them. So I'm in awe of that, and I feel like I stand on the shoulders of so many people who've come before me. My mentors, people who are now departed, Judy Jackson trained me. She just passed away this year. She was an amazing counselor, compassionate person. So I feel honored to be carrying the torch.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the warning signs that people might not know about in regard to suicide?
Well, there are a lot of them, and I think the thing to most pay attention to with your friends and your family, people you know well, is there a change? Is there a change in behavior? So somebody who normally sleeps well through the night and starts, you know, for quite a long time saying, "I'm not sleeping," somebody who might pick at their food, suddenly eating a lot. There's some that are, you know, we pass around a lot, the idea of gift giving, that someone say, "Here, you know, you like my iPod, take it, I don't need it anymore." But I think more, stay tuned to your friend's mood and what's going on in their life. If you know that they've been struggling with a lot of things and you're starting to see them shift away from the activities that usually lift them up, they're not going to the gym, they're not sleeping well, they're not going to hang out with their friends, they're not going to the movies anymore. So they're letting all of their support systems fall away.
Mm.
That's someone that I like to characterize as going into a downward spiral.
And physical appearance changes, too, in terms of change of hygiene. I mean, I think that was something that people saw with Heath Ledger.
Mm.
He had let his physical appearance fall apart. Andrew Koenig, Walter Koenig's son, who recently took his life, gave away his possessions to a former roommate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the warning signs were there. They were just blinking, you know, help, help, I need help. And so as Lee Ellen said, any change, if you know someone, any change in their behavior needs to be questioned.
You know, I remember when I was growing up, I used to hear people say, if someone says they're going to commit suicide, don't pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
If they're talking about it, means they won't.
I grew up with that. The ones who talk about it are not serious.
That's not true anymore in regard to the way we approach.
We've learned that that's not true, that people who talk about wanting to die are thinking about wanting to die. And perhaps they won't carry it through, but do you want your friend or your family member to go with that thought of, dying would be the best solution for me? I mean, even if they never act on that thought, shouldn't you take that statement as an indication of how seriously distressed they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we just have to look at this daunting statistic, Tish, that once every 90 minutes someone dies at their own hand in this country, but once every minute someone tries to die at their own hand. So those are attempts. And you can be sure that these people in some way were letting people around them know that they were contemplating that.
Now, a huge percentage of people who contemplate suicide or are suicidal have mental illness, and a lot of them also have substance abuse problems. How do you differentiate between somebody who really needs to go to a hospital and somebody who just does need some counseling?
Well, I mean, there's a whole assessment protocol that we teach our counselors. We ask them to check for imminent lethality, whether somebody is thinking about taking their life in the moment. But we learn how to quiet our own fears when we hear somebody saying, I want to die. That's a very scary thing. So what we say is, tell me about that. What hurts so much that you want to die? What is it in your life right now that makes you feel like dying is the only option? And so we want to let our people know that we can talk about this topic. This is a taboo topic. And I'm someone who has worked with a lot of taboo topics in my life. And so what we teach our counselors is to become comfortable in becoming conversant about feelings of depression, suicide, worthlessness, hopelessness, isolation. The more alone and isolated someone feels, the more in danger they are. And so part of what we do on the crisis line is to extend a hand and say, you're not alone right now. Someone is right here. Let's talk about it. And yes, it is true that most suicides do have an element of a mental health component. 60% of people are dealing with clinical depression or some form of mental health diagnoses. And definitely, alcohol and drugs play a huge part because 90% of suicides are lubricated by alcohol and suicide. They feel like they have to screw their courage up, you know, and have a couple of drinks. And then accidents can happen. Or you may not intend to die, but if you take too many pills and you drink too much alcohol, you will die.
Now, I know this is a little bit controversial, but there is research that indicates that the way that the media talks about suicide can affect suicides in different communities. You know, a lot of time it's glamorized. And talk to us a little bit about that subject.
Do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take that one. In general, newspapers no longer report most suicides. So it's easy to overlook the statistics that Mika was talking about a little earlier, that in this country, every minute, someone is trying to take their own life. The reports generally in the news are only if someone very famous has taken their life or if the suicide took place in a really public place. So people have been going, what's going on at Cornell? It's why is this all happening? And the truth is, young people between the ages of 14 and 24 are at high risk. It's the third leading cause of death. And if you get down to the college-age students, it's the second leading cause of death. The first being accidents. And many of those may actually be unidentified suicides or may have been reckless behavior brought on by suicidal thoughts, depression, lubrication of alcohol.
And we also know that teenagers are sometimes not thinking too clearly about anything that they do.
But that may also be, and it's the teenage brain and the young adult brain has got some particular learning to do, and there's actual physical development of the brain that will enhance their ability to think through their thoughts and make better judgments as they get a little older. Cornell had a lovely period of time where their suicide rate was extremely low, and actually there were no deaths for about 3 years, but that was unusual. Usual for a college of that size, given the national statistics. Cornell was doing exemplary work in a multi-tiered suicide prevention program across the campus. But statistically, you can have an anomaly. And in fact, there were 6 deaths on the campus. And we know about the most public ones, but there are many other means.
And then do you work with the college campuses and some of the schools? Do you guys work together? They have their own programs, but do they refer people to you?
Absolutely. Cornell has its own peer-supported hotline called EARS, but they're not 24/7. And so we do get a lot of calls from Cornell students, staff, and so we know a lot of what the referrals are on campus. And we do refer students back to mental health services on the campus. We coach them as to how to get an intake. And we also refer them a lot to the pastoral counseling through the Cornell United Religious Works. We know the chaplains there, and we know that they are also part and parcel of the emergency response team on campus. we have to work with Cornell. It's the city on the hill. And so many people who are Ithacans work for Cornell and go to school at Cornell. A lot of our counselors are Cornell students, either undergrad or graduate students, who are doing service or are thinking about going into psychological services. So they want to try it out. Mm-hmm. And they get an incredible experience working not only with people with clinical depression, but with multiple mental health issues and crisis issues. So.
Yeah. Now I noticed on your website that you started Adolescent Outreach, began in 1979. How does that work? How is that different? Did you have to get parents and guardians involved? Can you actually counsel kids underage?
Well, actually, the main program that we use to reach out to adolescents is to go into their health education classes. And we actually like to start with the seventh grade, occasionally get invited to do work with the older kids. But at the seventh grade level, the kids are facing that particularly rough patch where suicide is of high risk. And we come in and we tell them, this is what's going to happen. And you, your friends, are more likely to turn to you for help than to their parents or to a teacher or to call a hotline. Mm. So we need you to be aware of the signs and symptoms and the possibility of suicide. We need you to know how much a feature of youthful deaths it is. And we need you to know what to do. And that is to not be afraid to ask, are you thinking of killing yourself? Mm. And so they say, I can't just come right out and ask that. And I said, well, yeah, so you got some facts. You need to pay attention. You see your friend is not showing up at gym, failing classes, becoming isolated, staying home all day just to play computer games. For some, you know that's their normal behavior. But when that's not normal for a friend, it's okay to say, I saw that. You didn't go to gym. You're failing your classes. You're staying all day inside playing computer games. What's going on? I know you've got a lot in your life right now. Are you thinking of suicide? Mm. And it's a conversation. So we come in and we first do a little model of how that question might be asked. And then we turn short scenarios to them. And they practice paying attention, active listening, and asking what we call in our business, asking the question.
Uh-huh. Now, I also want to talk about the fact that you created a pamphlet directed to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender mm-hmm. populations. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the concerns there are with that community still?
Well, we do know that coming out can be an extraordinarily traumatic event, especially in an isolated rural area. Those are the calls we get. We've gotten a few calls from some Cornell students who are just coming out. I recently got a call from a young woman who had broken up with her girlfriend, and it wasn't even an LGBT issue. It was just a breakup issue that was about the normalizing of LGBT relationships. But we do get calls from people who are living on the down low, meaning that they have other lives. They may be in heterosexual marriages or relationships, but they are seeking partnerships with same-sex people in their rural areas. You know, we answer the phone for the 607 area code, so that includes beyond Tompkins County and the rural parts of mm-hmm. Tompkins County. And now we're an international organization. We're getting calls from all over the world because of Skype and because people have cell phones. And people move to New Mexico and they say, I used to live in Ithaca and I really like your crisis line, so I'm calling you. So that's part of what we teach in our training, sensitivity to LGBT and transgender issues. It's something to look for. People call us for many, many reasons, and we just offer them crisis counseling, active listening, reflection of feeling, and we also try to help them within the context of their lives. So we find out more about their situation, and we have referrals, and we refer back to the LGBT resources in the community. And there are some good resources on the campuses around us.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Mika Corazon and Lee Ellen Marvin from Suicide Prevention and Crisis Service of Tompkins County. Now, I want to talk to you about how you train people to be counselors. Can you tell if somebody's not meant to be in this business? How do you tell?
Well, we have an initial one-hour interview. They have to fill out a thoughtful essay application. Why do you want to do this? Mm. Have you had recent loss in your life? Have you yourself had thoughts of suicide? Anyone in your family taken their lives? So we're looking at the history of this person and their intention. And then we talk to them. And then we put them through a 47-hour training, which involves a lot of cognitive learning, but also a lot of experiential. They have to do a lot of role plays around particular issues. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people take themselves out of the candidacy to be a volunteer because emotional issues come up, or they say, this is too hard, or I thought I was over that. So we're very compassionate about that. And then we monitor them. They go through an apprenticeship, and then we monitor their calls for the first few months, and every once in a while I monitor calls without them knowing.
Uh-huh.
So a call can be any one of these things. It's kind of like a flow chart. If this happens, then go here. If that happens, then go here. We give them guidelines. A call is connecting with the person, understanding what's going on for them, and then assisting them within the context of their lives. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very intelligent, sophisticated training. It's the training I took. And
did everybody have to take it? Lee-Ellen, did you have to take the training?
I volunteered to take it, and I felt this is as important as CPR. I mean, this is this level of really understanding and knowing a lot about what brings about suicidal ideation, but also that active listening skill, that compassionate process of letting someone fully explain why they feel like they want to die, and then bring them towards discovering where in their own life they have resources, who they could turn to, what would make them feel different, or out of all these things going on, what would make the most difference? What one detail could we develop and move along and you know, might shift everything else? All those skills are so critical for friends. And I, you know, I'm finding with my friends and family that they tell me a lot more about what's happening in their life. And I'm no longer panicked when someone's having an upset day. Uh-huh. I say, all right, this is hard. I don't like seeing my friend or my family member going through this. But on the other hand, I know that what they most need from me is to not panic, but just to listen.
Yeah.
Just pay attention. Mm-hmm. And I'll hear things that I may be able to bring back to them as resources that they can use.
Yeah.
So I find myself growing calmer, and they then get calmer and get closer to what's really upsetting them.
I think that's probably a good attribute for almost anybody in any profession to stay calm.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I would say that our volunteers have really tapped into their emotional intelligence, and they tell us it's changed their lives and their relationships.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to point out that 11% of our callers are people who care about somebody who they think may be suicidal. So we're doing counseling and we're doing education with them as to how to approach that person. And only 12% of our callers are actively thinking of suicide. Most people who call are in crisis of some sort.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I read a statistic that said that suicide is the 11th most common cause of death in the U.S.
Yes.
And that's remarkable.
Across all age groups.
Across all age groups. Now, how do you deal with survivors of somebody who has actually committed suicide? You must get those sorts of calls as well.
We do. Those calls come to the line, and people who have been traumatized by the loss of a friend through suicide come to our post-trauma or after-trauma program. Ellen
Abrams
is our post-trauma counselor, and people can receive some free counseling and then some assistance in finding ongoing counseling resources. We also have a support group that meets twice a month and has been a tremendous resource for people who stagger with, you know, what happened? Why did my friend or my family member do this to themselves? For many people, it just completely knocks them blindside.
Oh, I'm sure it's an overwhelming guilt for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask you this, too, before we do run out of time. Do you get calls from terminally ill people? And how do you deal with that? I had Derek Humphrey on, who's a pioneer of the Right to Die movement.
Yes.
How do you deal with people who really are terminally ill and in horrible pain?
You know, I want to be honest that for each of us, we all have to do our own personal thinking about where we fit on that continuum. As an agency, our interest is making sure that if someone is experiencing terminal illness and great deal of pain, the focus in that counseling would be, where can you get the resources so you're struggling less with the pain? What kinds of things do you need to enjoy your life as it is right now? Mm-hmm. You know, it's possible that somebody has not yet had palliative care, which makes a significant difference in their enjoyment of life in their last days, or hospice care, which could do a really remarkable thing and provide more time for that dying patient to spend with their family and enjoy what they do have. So one thing is, are you getting the kind of support? And there may be callers who, you know, they just don't know these services are available.
Yeah.
So they don't have to be under extreme pain. The right to die with dignity is an important issue, and our job is to make sure that people get listened to about their wish to die.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And through that conversation, there may well be another avenue to explore, another approach to take, and, you know, an extension of life.
Mika, what about you? You worked with AIDS patients for a long time.
Yes, I ran a support group at R.K. Davies Hospital for many years of people with HIV. All of them had an exit plan. All of them were hoarding pills. All of them were saying, you know, if I lose my eyesight from CMV retinitis, I'll take the pills. There was a sense of empowerment, and we talked about it in the group. So what would that be like? And we didn't shy away from it. So you're feeling that ending your life is one way to take control in a situation that has taken all the control away from you. What's interesting is that when you talk about it, not one of them took their lives. Not one of them in the, I think, 6 years that I did that group.
Really?
They all had plans, and I think they found this out in Right to Die states, like Oregon. If people have worked with their doctor to set up some kind of exit strategy, or, you know, they have the medication to do that, they don't do it. There's not this sense of desperation that they have to do it because they have the bargaining chip. So every day they say, is this the day? Okay, maybe not. I can do this one more day.
That's fascinating to me. But now let's talk about some of the programs that you guys have developed. The SPCS role players. Now that sounds fascinating to me. That's your baby, Lee Allen.
That is
right?
My baby, but I have inherited that one from Ellen Schmidt. Something about her agency. Lots of people with Ellen in their names. Ellen Schmidt formed the Community Role Players, and it is a marvelous project. I came to it as a storyteller. I hadn't done theater in many years. I used to be a radio drama producer, and so I've worked with actors, and I've done a lot of teaching of storytelling, and every now and then we do a group project. But the role players are storytellers working together. It's all volunteer, and it's all improvisational. And I create a simple scenario that we then bring to a group of people, usually small. I don't like to work with more than 50 people. Mm. And we'll act out a scene that relates to something going on in that community. Most recently, we've been going into the middle schools to work on issues of sexual harassment and sexting, cyberbullying. Oh, yeah. And so we've been playing with these things in these stories that I kind of, they're a little more pushed out. They're a little more dramatic than perhaps real life, but they hit the nerves. And then the actors, who are all volunteers, stay in character, and the audience starts talking to the characters.
That's a fascinating way to open people up.
And we only bring it to, you know, what would be in a real play the equivalent of the first half of Act One, when the audience goes, oh, that's the problem here. And when you get to the problem, that's when I cut it off and say, all right, audience, you see, stuff's happening here. What are they going to do? So we might rerun a scene with an idea from the audience. Sometimes I'll get an audience member into the scene. We might have one character has to turn to another and say, stop it, I don't like it when you do that. And the audience coaches them in how to say to the character, you know, okay, this is, no, you can't do it in a little pleading voice. You have to do it firmly, says the audience,
great.
Right?
Do you use role-playing in your trainings as well?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. It's the integral part. We actually start role-playing from day one. Because how do you know what kind of counselor you'll be unless you are actually trying it on? So try on the counselor role. And they also get to try on the caller role. And they actually have experiences with the counseling process where they say, wow, I really felt angry or I really felt sad. But, of course, these are universal human emotions. We just tap into them a little bit and we'll be able to feel that they are real. You know, it really shows people, this act of listening works.
It does. Yeah, when I did a role play and I played someone who was considering taking her life. And in the middle of the role play, I suddenly looked at the person who was being the counselor and I just wanted them to go away and just leave me alone. I was like really astonished at that feeling that came up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I've been working on is developing stories. As you know, I'm very intrigued. Storytelling is my primary
art form. Absolutely, I do
and
remember
so
that.
I've written a story called Ringing the Bell, and it's a longish story. It's about 25 minutes long, about two high school students. And the real emphasis, the catch point of the story is the girl who realizes her friend is in serious trouble and her friend is in a vulnerable place. And she wants to get on with her life. She wants to get to school. She's got lots of books. She cares about her grades. But she has to put all of that aside to go back to her friend to say, hey, what's really going on?
Mm.
And that's a moment that I think for anyone who does get this kind of training or suddenly, even without the training, realizes they're in a position where they have to ask someone, are you thinking of suicide? So I wanted to really work my story around that to give people a chance to internally practice taking that deep breath and going after their friend and saying, what's happening?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you ever experienced a loss during, you know, your time with this organization? And do you guys all get together and talk about how you feel about it?
I have not. I had a loss before I came to this work, but actually quite a few years before.
Mm-hmm.
And I came into the work thinking, well, I don't have any personal contact with suicide. And then over the next few weeks, I found myself making a list of the people who had died by suicide who mattered to me, including Anne Sexton, the poet.
Oh, me too.
Who died when I was a young woman in college, and I was furious with her.
I was still too.
I
got a letter from her, actually, about 9 months before she died.
Oh, my goodness.
I was terribly upset about that one.
Yeah. And a businesswoman in town who I was just beginning to be friends with, and I made an empty chair about losing her as a friend, as a potential friend.
Well,
and
what about you, Mika?
Yeah. Well, I've had, because of my work with HIV and living in San Francisco for 22 years, I have had a lot of friends who took their lives, mostly what they would consider quality of life suicide after dealing with HIV or dealing with cancer. But I have friends who are still angry at them for those decisions. I realize that I can't judge that. I know that I want to be available to people so that they don't feel isolated and alone. And I do know that, you know, I allow people to talk about what the pain they're in and maybe the idea that they want to take their lives. But I, you know, I also realize that people have self-determination. It's kind of interesting because on the crisis line, we have a directive. And the directive is we prevent suicide. Mm-hmm. We do everything we can. Mm-hmm. In a respectful and compassionate way. And then if we hear that one of our callers has taken their life, we have to then work with the counselors who feel that they failed.
Yeah,
you know?
I can imagine that.
And what I want to say is, well, let's talk about those feelings. But ultimately, what people do is really up to them. In that moment, we interject ourselves and we say, you're not alone. And on another level is, you know, I used to do HIV counseling, and I used to have to tell people that they had HIV. And as an educator, I would tell them everything they needed to do to not get HIV, and they would get HIV. I'm not going to judge that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we do only have a couple minutes left. I want to mention the Empty Chairs Project really quickly, and then let's talk a little bit about upcoming events.
Well, the Empty Chairs Project was a project for people who had lost someone to suicide, and we call those people suicide survivors because the impact is so amazing. Their lives are completely changed by that loss. Mm-hmm. And it was the idea of Marie Sirakis, who held the position of director of the Role Players before me, that we could give people a chair that they would then alter, decorate, paint, as a way of expressing their loss and the person that they miss in their lives.
Yeah, and placing someone in that chair, the someone that they remember, perhaps.
Well, perhaps, but we gave people permission to express what the feeling of the loss is. And it's our hope that someone who saw the chair, if they consider taking their own life, that they might say, yeah, but then there was that chair. That might give them just a moment of stop and think, my mom will kill me if I do this to myself, right?
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people say, my family will be so angry if I do
this.
Absolutely. That Empty Chair Project I thought was absolutely brilliant.
And people can see pictures of the empty chairs online, but we're also going to exhibit the chairs in an empty storefront on the Commons in the month of September.
Great, and what else is coming up?
Well, we've got a big event we are working like crazy on called the Reach Out Walk for Suicide Prevention. The goal is to raise both awareness and funds, and we're inviting people to donate $15 or more. If they pre-register, they may be eligible for a special incentive gift that we've been working on. Mm-hmm. It's modeled a little bit after Take Back the Night by the Advocacy Center, so it will start on both campuses, Cornell and Ithaca College, and also down at Washington Park at the corner of Buffalo and Park Street.
And is this happening in September as well?
September 19th, that's a Sunday, and the marches start at 1 o'clock and then convene on the Bernie Milton Pavilion, where we'll be hearing music by Ayurveda and Joe Crookston, and we'll have speakers as well.
Oh, that's great. Contact information.
For our office number is 607-272-1505, and anyone can call the crisis line 24/7 at 607-272-1616.
Okay. Well, Lee Ellen Marvin and Mika Corazon, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you, Tish.
Again, we've been talking to Suicide Prevention and Crisis Service. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.